Good morning.
I just found this fortune cookie. Fortune. It fell out of my pocket. And I picked it up and it says, adversity is the prosperity of the great.
What are the lucky numbers?
You can all go home now.
Would you read it again?
Adversity is the prosperity of the faith of the great. I'll say it again. Adversity is the prosperity of the great. So don't despair. So I'm going to continue from where I left off yesterday. Suzuki Roshi says, we have to understand things in two ways. One way is to understand things as interrelated. The other way is to understand ourselves as quite independent from everything. When we include everything as ourselves, we are completely independent because there is nothing with which to compare ourselves. If there is only one thing, how can you compare anything to it? Because there is nothing to compare yourself to, this is absolute independence, not interrelated, absolutely independent. So here independent actually means at one with. But I read this part yesterday, I think. So this is a description actually of Zazen. You know, if we look at it like the ocean, I want to talk about Zazen and the kitchen. Two aspects of Zazen. So when we sit with our legs crossed, this is like sinking deeply into the ocean. And when we work in the kitchen, it's like riding the waves. The waves belong to the ocean. The ocean is, the waves are the activity of the ocean, and the ocean is the essence of the waves, the body of the waves. So there's really no difference between the waves and the ocean. The ocean is just simply the various activities that take place seemingly on the surface of the ocean. So, Suzuki Roshi once said, Zazen is like, or Sesshin is like being a turtle when drawing in all its legs. Nothing can harm you. Or you're well protected, even though you may not think you're protected, you're well protected in Zazen. It doesn't matter if someone comes and cuts your head off. That's happened, actually. That happened to several Zen masters. But sometimes it happened that the Zen master would, when the robbers came, just sit there in Zazen, and the robbers would look at him and go away. There's nothing to take. So why would you bother with this guy when there's nothing to take from him? Anyway. So we have to understand things in two ways. One way is in Zazen, in sitting, cross-legged, is great dynamic activity within stillness. And when we work in the kitchen, it's profound stillness within activity. It's the same thing, it's just the reverse. But the qualities are the same. So kitchen is just another way to practice Zazen. And in Zazen, we let go of anything that's superficial. We let go of our props and crutches and just allow our self nature to reveal itself. So we don't add anything to it. And we don't take anything away. Whatever we can lose doesn't belong to us. This is what Zazen is. Whatever we can lose is not ours to begin with. So what's really fundamental, it cannot be lost, and it cannot be gained. So it's just what is. So when we do Zazen thoroughly, it's very difficult, because what we bring is our dependencies. So we come and sit down, and our mind is working, and our bodies, the postures that we take in our bodies, are dependent on our state of mind. You know, the state of mind determines our postures. If we are fearful, then it shows up in our posture. If we're anxious, it shows up in our posture and our deportment. So whatever our state of mind is, influences our postures. So very difficult to sit up straight, which is normal. It's very difficult to find the norm, because the norm is that which is not influenced by anything. So we call it innocent, or natural, or fundamental. So in Zazen, we have to let go. If we say there's some goal at all, it's to let go of all the props that are holding us up. That's why we sit up straight, and we don't lean against anything. We don't lean against the wall. We don't our effort is to keep shedding anything that doesn't belong to us. Then we have our freedom. And of course, that which is the most dear to us is our self-centeredness, our ego. So, as eventually, we have to let go of that as well. So, working in the kitchen, we have to find our composure. In Zazen, as we let go of everything, we have to find our composure without being propped up. So when we work in the kitchen, or when we do any activity, of course, but I'm using the kitchen as an example, we have to find our composure so that we can work smoothly and harmoniously in a small space with other people, and produce something for the Sangha within a certain space of time. It can't be too late. The food can't get burned. It can't be, we can't get angry at people because they're not doing what we think they should be doing. So this is a great, you know, the kitchen itself is a great cooking pot. It's like the cauldron. the cauldron cooks. The cauldron cooks sages and Zen masters. It's very hot. It's very hot. So, if when we observe, we can see how everyone is affected when they work in this space, and the cooks especially, because the cooks have a great responsibility to deal with the menus, make sure that everything is there, be able to ask this one to do that and that one to do this, and at the same time make sure that everything is going along as it should. So some people get very nervous. Some people get very angry. Cooks. And some people just have good composure. So, but this is the way it is with Zazen, right? In Zazen, some people get very anxious. Some people get very nervous. Some people get very angry. I've never understood that. But people come to me and they say, in Zazen, I get very angry, very angry. And I wonder why. I think one reason why is because we want the world to conform to us. But, you know, in life we have to conform to the world. When we conform to the world, then the world naturally conforms to us because we are flexible. But when we're not flexible, the world can't conform to us. And Ross has his hand up already.
I hope it's relevant. You spoke yesterday about the food in Japan being not so nutritious.
And I did. Oh no, the food in Japan.
In the monasteries, yes. So maybe it's simple, you know, rice, miso soup, pickle, and it's the same thing with very little variation. And in light of what you just said about the complexities of the kitchen and all the flavors, here in America, as much as I love the food here at Berkeley Zen Center, I wonder if the cauldron is the same in Japan, or is it a different kind of practice, and the tenzos are not working in the same way as they work here.
I'm getting to that. Thank you. So, typically, ordinarily, in the past, in the monastic life, food has always been offered to the monastery. The monks, well, it goes different ways. In China, in India, monks couldn't dig in the earth or handle money, and everything that they ate was offered. That's why we say in the meal chant, may our virtue and practice deserve this food. Because the only way the monks got fed was through their virtue and practice. If they didn't have any virtue and practice, nobody would feed them. So that was the reason for receiving food. So arhat, the word arhat means one who is worthy of being fed. But we're in a different situation. Mostly lay people who work for a living, and we pay for our sashin. We pay, you know. But still, we pay for the sashin, we pay for the food, somebody buys it. But this is not too different from monastic practice, except that the monks don't pay for the food. So, you know, when you just beg for your food on the street, you just take whatever's offered. That's it. You can eat it or not eat it. But usually the monks go out and beg for the food, and then they put all the food together, and they have a communal meal, right? Then they have cooks. So cooks and kitchen workers are part of practice. They've always been part of practice. So as soon as the meals are part of practice, they're treated as practice. So it's we don't put a chef, gourmet chef, as the tenzo in the kitchen, because not that that's not good food, but if the attitude is different than a tenzo practices, because the whole thing is practice, not just a job. We're not trying to turn out gourmet food, but so the question is, you know, what kind of food do we try to produce for the monks? And in Japan, in the olden days, monks were just dependent on offerings. So the food sometimes was okay, sometimes not okay. Sometimes it was nutritious, sometimes not nutritious. So, but the attitude was that whatever it is, that's what you eat. In our society, we live in the cornucopia of the world. California. Berkeley Bowl. the premier grocery store of the world. So we have a lot of choice, you know, which gives us a problem. So, ordinarily, you can shop and do whatever you want. You know, eat anywhere you have. You can go to Chinese restaurants, Japanese restaurants, Mexican restaurants, hamburger joints. But when we come to the sashin, we eat the food that's provided, you know, by the. When we do offer the money, but we don't say anything about the food. We don't say, I'm gonna give you my $40 or whatever it's for sashin, and I want this. You know, great. I thought about this. I thought about the servers coming in. The whole notebook. What would you
Should we tip it?
Anyway, that's getting a little out there. But, so what do we serve? How do we... What's our attitude in serving food and in making food, creating food for the Sangha? So, you know, this is 7 days where it's a monastic practice, quasi-monastic practice. 7 days of hibernation with, because we have a complete practice, it's not just a sitting practice. Many meditation practices now, you know, you go to a retreat and you just have a sitting practice and then someone makes the meals for you. You hire people to make the meals. They used to do that in monasteries in China in the beginning, back in the 6th century. The monks would hire people to cook for them and all that, and they'd have tea about 8 or 9 times a day before Bodhidharma. Who introduced, he said, no, sit down. It doesn't. But so we have a monastic attitude toward what we're doing. So this, since our practice is simple, the food should be compatible with the simplicity of our practice. And I always advocate simple food for the practice. It can be the same food every day. But what, you know, because but we're such gourmets that we have to have a different food every single day, every single meal. And nothing can be repeated. Which is okay. Variety is wonderful. But it's not necessary. Sometimes I say, yeah, we can have oatmeal two or three times two or three times during the, you know, when you eat at home, usually for breakfast, you mostly eat the same thing every day, most people. Few, little variety, but when we come to sashin, we have to have something different every day. So it's really strange. So someone was saying that they felt that they had to compete with some of the other tenzos, different one every day, in order to get some extraordinary meal out. And so I think, yeah, we should compete, but not that way. It's okay to compete to see who can make the simplest meal out of the most ordinary ingredients that is fit for a Zen student. That's our real practice, is to take the simplest ingredients and bring out what they have to offer without covering them with something else. Gourmet meals often are combinations of this and that, and put together in such a way that they enhance each other, that's great, and make a kind of beautiful magic delicacy. That's okay, no problem. But problem is that once we get into that, we start creating food in our head, and then it comes out kind of like it's great, but there's something about it that is not fit for a Zen student. In Japan, they have the kaiseki. Kaiseki is Zen food. The temple Zen food is great. It's fantastic. And it's mostly little things that are in the little dishes. And each one is exquisite, you know. But that's guest food. It's not monk's food. And when you're a guest, you serve kaiseki, you know, and you savor each dish, and it's great. But when you go to Zendo, you eat rice and miso soup, you know. So, Zendo practice is more rice and miso soup, but I don't think we should just eat rice and miso soup. I think we should have nice menus, but instead of trying to put a lot of ingredients together to make something really special, to bring out the flavors, the natural flavors of the plain food, ordinary food, and to make it, I think that a good chef is not the one who puts a lot of stuff together to make an exquisite thing, but one who takes a simple ingredient and really eases out or there's a word there, coaxes out the natural flavors without covering them over as a head trip. We don't need to do that, because it can get into kind of ego trip. But actually, the tastiest foods are the ones where that simple and the flavors can be enhanced by other flavors as well, but not to cover the original flavor. And this is Zazen. That's what we're doing in Zazen. It's the same thing. We're bringing out the original flavor of our life in Zazen. without covering it over with something else, or needing to prop it up with something else. So, zazen and kitchen work, same thing. And also, when the tenzo is working with the kitchen staff, how does the tenzo bring out the flavor of each student? Everyone has their own flavor. Every person has their own flavor. And how does the tenzo allow that flavor to arise in the student? Without, you don't have to be bossy, but the student has to be willing. So I always said that when you go to the kitchen, as a kitchen worker, your attitude is toward the tenzo, what would you like me to do, and how would you like me to do it? But so often, the kitchen worker says, I know how to do that. I've been doing that all my life. I can do it. You don't do it that way, you do it this way. So then they set up a kind of disturbance. To just be able to receive, to offer yourself and receive what's given, and do it that way. And so, the tenzo should be able to say to the worker, this is how I would like you to do it. I want you to cut the carrots this way, not that way. And you say, oh, okay, I'll cut it this way, and I won't cut it that way. So everybody's working together harmoniously with their egos way in the back and not in the front. And then you have a wonderful time. Well, working in the kitchen is so much fun doing sashimi. It's a little different from zazen in that way. But when you're totally concentrated and working harmoniously with yourself, intimately with yourself, intimately with the tool, intimately with the ingredient, concentrated, totally concentrated, and aware of what's going on around you, and weaving in and out in a harmonious way, it's just great. It's like life is fun, you know. Why should it be so difficult? It's joyful. Maybe fun is not the right word. It's a joyful experience. It should be a joyful experience. It can be a joyful experience. And the joy that rises up through that experience is fundamental joy, not just fleeting joy. In the head temples, Eiji Sojiji, Japan, the tenzo is always the roshi, someone who's a teacher. So we ask people to be tenzo, and if they don't have confidence, they'll think, well, I'm not a teacher, I'm just, you know, doing this. But actually, you have to be able to put yourself in that place. Even if you're not a teacher. Teacher doesn't mean that you're teaching people a lot of things. It means that you're acting with composure. That's all. You're acting with composure. And then everyone else is at ease. When you're not acting with composure, people are not at ease around you. So you find your own composure. It means you're not being pushed by the time, you're not being pushed by the ingredients, you're not being pushed by how everybody's doing. You simply are acting within stillness, and then everything comes out the way it should, without having to do much. If you are maintaining composure, complete composure, then all of your actions are coming out of composure instead of out of anxiety. I only have so much time to do this. Sets up anxiety. So when you feel that anxiety, you just come back to composure. Oh. And then start from there. You're always starting from composure. When you have anxiety or fear, stop and come back to composure. And then you're always coming out from composure. And then things around you are harmonizing with you because you're harmonizing with them. So that's how we work in the kitchen. And it's just zazen. So our complete practice means not just sitting with our legs crossed, but during sesshin, practicing in the kitchen and serving. Serving is the same thing. It's so much fun, so joyful to serve people, to serve the Sangha. It makes us feel young again. Someone said. So it's the same attitude. When we have composure, we don't bump into each other. We don't, you know, try to hurry up, go too slow or go too fast. Sometimes people think mindfulness means that we should go, as Alan was saying yesterday, that mindfulness means we should go real slow and do everything real slow. No, it simply means we should do everything with composure. So if it needs to be quick, it's quick. If it needs to be slow, it's slow. It has nothing to do with that. It has something to do with just being composed, so that when it's time to go slow, you go slow, and when it's time to go quickly, you go quickly. And you know which is which. What Suzuki Roshi talked about more than anything else was composure. You should always be finding your composure in big mind. So then he says, now the text says, all the objects of the senses, the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body, are gates. And sense objects enter the gates. We talked about sense objects and the senses. They are interrelated and at the same time independent. For eyes, there's something to see. For ears, there's something to hear. For nose, there's something to smell. For the tongue, something to taste. For the body, something to touch. There are five kinds of sense objects for the five sense organs. This is Buddha's common sense. Referring to them here in the poem, it's just a way of saying everything. It's just using those as everything is interrelated. So, it's the same as saying flowers, trees, birds, and stars, streams, and mountains. But instead, he says each sense and its objects. So the various beings that we see and hear are interrelated. But at the same time, each being is absolutely independent and has its own value. So this value we call Re. Re is that which makes something meaningful. You remember Re and Ji, right? Re is the noumenal, Ji is the phenomenal side. Re is Sazen, Ji is working in the kitchen. So this value we call Re. Re is that which makes things something meaningful. Not just theoretical. Even though you don't attain enlightenment, we say you already have enlightenment. This enlightenment we call Re. The fact that something exists here means there is some reason for it. I don't know the reason, no one knows, but everything must have its own value. It's very strange that no two things are the same. So there is nothing to compare yourself to. So you have your own value. So later he calls what he calls your own value, virtue. Because value has the sense of being comparative. My car is worth so much money, you know, my house is worth so much money, I am worth so much, and she's not worth so much. So we're always comparing, right? This is the realm of G, the realm of comparative values. But virtue means that which is not compared, that you can't compare anything to. So each one of us has our own virtue, which is incomparable. Incomparable means no way to compare. So when Suzuki Roshi addressed us, or talked to us, he talked to us in the realm of virtue, not its value, not that you are less or more than somebody else, but you are totally you, and that's what gives you your virtue. Because there's nothing to compare you to. So this is your Buddha nature, which is incomparable. So that value is not a comparative value or an exchange value. It is more than that. When you were just sitting zazen on the cushion, you have your own value or virtue. Although the value is related to everything, that value is also absolute. Maybe it's better not to say too much about that, is what he said. So in the third line of the poem of this particular set of four is interacting brings involvement. A bird comes from the south in the spring and goes back in the fall, crossing various mountains, rivers, and oceans. In this way, things are interrelated endlessly, everywhere. Otherwise, each keeps its place. That's the fourth line. This means that even though the bird stays in some place, at some lake, for instance, his home is not only the lake, but also the whole world. That is how a bird lives. So there's no false boundary. So in Zen, sometimes we say that each one of us is steep, like a cliff. No one can scale us. We are completely independent. But when you hear me say so, you should understand that the other side is also true. That we are endlessly interrelated. So independent and interrelated. Right? If you only understand one side of the truth, you can't hear what I'm saying. If you don't understand Zen words, you don't understand Zen, and you are not a Zen student. This is really important. If you take everything literally, you know, Chinese language is poetic. Even though I think it seems, if you don't know it, it seems sing-song, you know, but it's very poetic. And Chinese people think in poetic terms and speak in poetic terms, especially ancient China. And so their speaking is poetic. And something like Sandokai is poetic. And when you try to put it into prose, it doesn't work very well. And the Zen masters, back in the Tang Dynasty, were poets. In the sense that the language, that's the way that they think in those days. So they're always using metaphors and using one word to mean something, maybe it's opposite. Quite often it's opposite. And we do that too. You know, when people 2,000 years analyze our language, they think that when we say, oh shit, you know, they think, oh, I'm talking about defecation. When they talk about defecation, they must be pooping all the time. The language is like that, you know. If we take it all literally, we get lost, and then we argue about it. So Zen words are different from usual words, like a double-edged sword. They say one thing, but they mean something else. You may think, and so he talks about a double-edged sword, like a double-edged sword. They cut both ways. So cutting both ways is like, you hold it back and you go forward. But when you go back, you have to be careful what's behind you, because if somebody's standing behind you, they're going to hit with a sword. So it goes both ways. So he says, you may think I am only cutting forward. But no, actually, I'm also cutting backward. Watch out for my stick. Do you understand? Sometimes I scold a disciple. No. And the other students think, oh, he has been scolded. But it's not actually so. because I can't scold the one over there, I have to scold the one who's next to me. That's true. I remember him doing that many times. And one time, I was supposed to ring the wake-up bell at Pagestein. This is a famous story during Sashin. And somehow the clock said, it was too early. So I got up an hour early and rang the wake-up bell. And everybody started coming out of their rooms. And they were looking at their... Wait a minute. And Suzuki Roshi came up. And then people were thinking, well, we should go back to our rooms and get another hour's sleep. But he said, no, go to the Zendo. The bell rang. Go to the Zendo. It has nothing to do with what time it is. When the bell rings, you just go to the Zendo. So everybody went back to the Zendo, and then he went around to hit everybody. But he didn't hit me. Because I didn't go to the Zendo. Understand?
Where were you?
Well, I'm just kind of standing out there bewildered. That was a long time ago. I lost my composure. So he would do things like that. And that's very common in Japan, when he wants to scold the monk over here, you hit the person next to him. Why do you do that? It's just a double-edged sword. When you go down the line, use the kyusaku, the stick, when you hit one person, everybody wakes up. So it's like everything is interconnected. This is like an example of how everything is interconnected. You do something over here, and something over here gets affected.
In seventh grade, I had a teacher and whose way of maintaining discipline was if somebody was talking, he'd take an eraser, blackboard eraser, and he'd throw it at them. But his aim was poor. So he'd usually hit somebody else, but there'd be this sort of cloud of chalk dust, and everything would stop, and the whole class would just go back to what it needed to be, and it was great. It was like this great teaching.
Yeah. So here he gives an example. He says, when I was quite a young disciple, my Dharma brothers and I went somewhere with our teacher and came back pretty late, maybe three or four of his young guys. They were pretty young, I think 10 or 12. There were many venomous snakes in Japan. There are. My teacher said, you are wearing tabi. You know what tabi? White socks, right? Japanese white socks. You are wearing tabi, and I am not, but they're sandals, so their toes are sticking out. A snake might bite me, so you go ahead. We agreed and walked ahead of him. As soon as we reached the temple, he said to us, all of you sit down. We didn't know what had happened, but we all sat down in front of him. What inconsiderate boys you are, he said. When I am not wearing tabi, why do you wear tabi? I gave you a warning. I'm not wearing tabi. You should have understood and taken off your tabi, too. But instead, you kept them on and walked ahead of me. What silly boys you are. This is an interesting story. I mean, it's a little bit crazy, but it's like teaching, Zen teaching in Japan is 20% instruction and 80% observation. You don't get taught by instruction. You get taught by observation. I was never taught how to do the service or how to do the bells or any of that stuff. We were never taught that. We just learned it through observation. Everything we learned is through observation. That's the method of non-method that was used by all the Japanese teachers. It was just intuition, because when you're observing, you're intuiting what you need to know. And in America, we expect everybody, you know, why didn't you tell me this? Why? People would ask Suzuki Roshi a question, why do we do this and why do we do that? He said, oh, we just do it. I don't know why. We just do it. You never give a reason for anything. No reasons. Just do it. That's the instruction. Just do it. And therefore, you don't have to argue with anybody. You don't have to explain anything. Sometimes explanation is good, you know. So, but the explanation is very poetic. For instance, before we, back in the 60s, nobody had roxas. We didn't have lay ordination, except for a few people. And, but we used to have the meal chant, not the, the robe chant. In the morning, after zazen, we'd do the robe chant. We didn't have any English translation. So I asked Suzuki Roshi, what is that chant that we do in the morning when after zazen? And what is the translation of that? And Katagiri started looking through the drawers, you know, to see if he could find one. And Suzuki Roshi said, pointed to his heart, and he said, love. So he didn't have to explain anything. He just gave me something more than I asked for. He would always give me something more than I would ask for. So he says, we should be alert enough to hear the meaning behind the words, that's all. We should realize something more than what is said. So then he talks about gives us another example, which you probably know about. One night, when I was a student at a Heiji monastery, I opened the right side of the sliding shoji door, because it is customary to open that side. But I was scolded, don't open that side, one of the senior monks said. So the next morning, I opened the left side, and I was scolded again. Why did you open that side? I didn't know what to do. When I opened the right side, I was scolded, and when I opened the left side, I was scolded again. Scolding, you know. Japan, the teacher, if you do something wrong, you'll get scolded, even though you don't get a reason. But you never get anything if you do something right. And I just inherited that kind of way of doing things, but people would really complain a lot to me. You know, you never compliment me, you never say when I do something right. And well, there's something to that, you know. So now I effusively tell people when they do well, and I think it's helpful. So that's American innovation. but still, you can go overboard. But I think it's good, because we need reinforcement, you know. But it's a different kind of attitude in Japan. It's like, you have to come up to the practice. That's just the way it is. It's not like there's no accommodation. You have to fight. It's like the salmon going up the stream. That's what Zen practice is compared to in a real, when it's really strong, when it's really is like the salmon going up the stream. You have all this. What was that thing that I just read you? Adversity is the prosperity of the great. That's the attitude. You have to fight your way up and really work hard. And there's very little accommodation. It's mostly, you know, like that. And you have to fight your way to get there. And that brings out your strong spirit. And more than you would think you have, if you continue. So when I opened the right side, I was scolded. And when I opened the left side, I was scolded again. I couldn't figure out why. But at last, I noticed that the first time, a guest had been on the right side. And the second time, a guest had been on the left side. So both times, I had opened a side so that a guest had been exposed. That was why I was scolded. At Aeji, they never told us why. They just scolded us. And then you had to figure out why. Your words were double-edged. The Sandokai's words are also double-edged. One side is interdependence, ego, and the other side is absolute independence, fu ego. This interdependency goes on and on everywhere, and yet things stay in their own places. That's the main point of the Sandokai. So, you may have some questions about that.
I don't know if it's about that, but I was thinking, where does just doing it, just doing what you're told, meet finding out for yourself?
I couldn't hear.
I said, where does just doing it, you know, as you're told or as is demonstrated for you, or the Tenzo tells you to chop a carrot a certain way, meet the teaching of finding out for yourself, being your own authority, according to the Buddha?
Well, there's there's finding out how, in that particular case, I would say it's finding out how to do what you're asked to do by yourself. Someone asked me to do this, so how can I actually do it? In that case. But there, in the kitchen there's more instruction because you don't want chaos. Right. Yeah, there's more instruction because, you know, if one was to say, well, just cut the carrots however you like, well, they wouldn't fit in to the dish the way it should be prepared. So you have to give instruction. So the way to find out for yourself is, do I, is this taking anything away from me? Is this taking away my individuality? It's a good koan if you have any resistance. If you don't have any resistance, then everything flows. But if you have resistance, then it gives you a little problem. And then you have to deal with that problem yourself. So there's always, you know, there's often resistance. Not too much though, people are pretty compliant. But not everything is that way. So, but actually we don't practice that way. It's just too difficult. Also, in Japan, you know, a lot of the practitioners are young people, so they're not formed as older people, and they're more malleable, and can actually, you know, they should pay. They're more willing to do what their elders say. But also you should understand that the meaning behind the words, and I think everything, it goes in a certain way. Right? It's not like it's not always so. I have a little footnote that I wrote a long time ago. It says, students often feel that if they submit to giving themselves over to practice completely, they will lose themselves or lose something. I give you this much, but I'm going to keep this much. I have to keep this much for myself. So there's a koan, you know. The buffalo jumps through the window. All the head, the feet, the body, all go through the window, except for the tail, that little tail. Why does that little tail not go through the window? That little tail is a big problem for us. Because, you know, the tail can get caught in the window and then the buffalo is hanging by the tail, and that's really painful. That's what really causes us the most pain, is that little tail that won't go through the window because the whole body's pulling on it. And it's really painful. Okay.